Mr. Henry Bemis woke and slowly opened his eyes. The world before him was an ambiguous mass of blurry blobs of color, smudged together as though viewing a piece of abstract art through murky water. He yawned, stretched, and swept his favorite book and his thick glasses off his stand in one swipe. Once Henry's spectacles were in place, he pulled the covers over his head like a child and read voraciously as a starving man. Agnes slammed the bedroom door open and ripped her middle-aged husband from his book-induced dream world. He needed to get to work now. If he was late again, he would lose his job at the bank. Henry sighed, which earned a stern look from his wife, Agnes. He had one great ambition in life. He wanted to read a book, cover to cover, straight through. The only issue was time. Henry never seemed to have the time, and based on the look on Agnes's face, now was not the time either. Henry didn't really have any time to himself. All of his time either belonged to his wife, or was purchased by his boss, Mr. Carsville. It made Henry so frustrated. Sitting down to read seemed like such a simple, harmless ambition compared to that of most other men, but he never seemed to have the time. Agnes peered down at him reading a magazine under the breakfast table. Her glare was like that of an eagle eyeing its prey, predatory and cold. She thought him childish and stupid, but if she was right, it wasn't his fault. Henry had always had villainously weak vision, though he hadn't always known it. When he was a child, he had earned terrible marks in school for years. It was ages before his parents realized that what they had thought was idiocy was simple bad vision. By the time his glass lenses had been carefully crafted for his nearly useless eyes, he was years behind his fellow students. Despite his voracious appetite for written word, he could never really seem to catch up. Perhaps Agnes would have understood his passion better if he shared it with her. He had tried once, but when he opened the book of poetry he longed to read to her, he found that Agnes had spitefully blacked out every word with heavy, dark ink. He broke down. How could she do something so spiteful? Why would she? It seemed so full of a hostility that he had never earned. "Henry!" Agnes shrieked, pulling her husband from his memories. In one swift move, she snatched the magazine he was reading from under the table, and in one smooth toss, chucked it into the fire. "Back to the real world, Henry. Remember, there's no time for daydreams. Remember, to get home on time tonight, it's bridge night with the Joneses. No lollygagging, no delays. We don't have time for you to waste. Get home, get dressed, get shaved. We need to be ready for them to come over." Henry barely heard her. He was too busy watching the magazine burn. Agnes followed his glance and complained vaguely about having burned the TV schedule. With an irritated grunt, Agnes turned away from her submissive husband and began her usual bustle about the house, seeming much more cheerful at the idea of his looming departure. Henry Bemis pushed his glasses up his nose and made a note to ask his doctor to adjust the slippery things when he visited for an extra pair. These ones had felt a little too loose lately, and the legally blind man only trusted his own personal doctor with his special glasses. He secured the hooks more firmly over his ears as he rose and started off to the bank. Mr. Bemis bumbled and breezed towards his work, pausing only to cast a longing glance at the library as he passed. He had never entered the building. All of his time belonged to Agnes or Mr. Carsville, but the beautifully domed structure always struck him with daydreams of all the books he had heard of and longed to explore one day. Henry pushed his glasses up his sweaty nose and continued on in a happy haze. He was pulled from his own musings again when he reached the bank, where Mr. Carsville swooped on him like a hawk, then circled like a vulture.
"Bemis," Mr. Carsville squawked, "you are fully 7 minutes late. Get to your booth at once."
The stiff man then turned on his heel and marched off in search of someone else to dominate, adjusting his massive signet ring along the way. Henry was largely unbothered. Halfway through his boss's scolding, he was already daydreaming of reading David Copperfield under his desk if it was a slow day. Henry was having a boring shift.
A boring woman complained loudly that he had miscounted her boring change before moving on with her boring life. She paid no mind to Henry's attempts to discuss David Copperfield with her. She simply counted and recounted her money, then vanished with a huff and a sharp look. His fingers twitched towards the leather-bound cover of David Copperfield. If only he could have a moment to himself. He had it. He told Mr. Carswell that he needed more bills of larger denominations for his drawer. He deferred to his boss's ego, leadership, and authority and all that, and Carswell adjusted his massive signet ring again before waving Henry on. Henry walked to the back room, then down the stairs, and into the heavy vault where he closed the massive door with a grunt. He immediately dug a rolled-up newspaper from within his pocket, which he had taken from the front desk counter. There, in big, bold, beautiful black, were the words, "The new weapons and what they will do to you." This was just one more in a wide world of things he wanted to know. He licked his thumb and forefinger and turned to the page. Without warning, the world exploded. The sound was deafening, and the world shook violently as the sound that seemed to come from both all around Henry and even within him. His own screams were inaudible in the cacophony that put more and more pressure on his head as he collapsed, wrenching and bucking onto the ground in a faint. When Henry regained consciousness, the world around him was stark silent, a sterile kind of silent that feels stuffy and unnatural. Mr. Bemis would have thought nothing of it in the privacy of the bank vault, but not with the vault's door open. Well, sort of open. The great metal door had been wrenched off its hinges and lay tilted on the floor, rising to nearly meet the half-collapsed ceiling that had sloped downward. The overall effect was that of being in a carnival funhouse where the room seemed to get smaller and smaller the farther one traveled along a corridor. Henry held his glasses in place with one hand as he struggled to escape what used to be the bank with the other. On the floor, a hand and forearm reached out from under a piece of rubble. Upon the third finger glinted a massive, gaudy signet ring. Blast! Henry had been hoping that Mr. Carswell would know what to do next, but it seemed his boss was no longer in a position to lead the bumbling Mr. Bemis. The visually impaired banker shuffled through the wreckage that used to be the bank, the street, the town. Every few feet, a soft, lumpy form would be piled on the ground. It wasn't until Henry stepped on one of these fleshy lumps that he realized they used to be his neighbors. It was the first and last time Henry Bemis wished his vision was worse. He thought it was best not to look too closely at any of these anymore, but the avoidance led him to walk into a twisted scrap of auto wreckage that dug deeply into his leg. Henry wrapped his handkerchief around the gouge that metal had torn into his flesh. He pushed up his glasses and limped on, forcing himself to face the devastation around him. Miles of bare, grayish-brown earth touched miles of grayish-brown sky, grayish-brown ruins of what was once a lively, bustling town. There were no voices, no wind, just suffocating silence. There was no one to help him, no one to call. He had started staggering home when it occurred to him that he should be able to see it by now, but he saw nothing. His home was gone, and Agnes with it. He was utterly alone. Henry sat and rested his wounded leg on the stone steps of what took him far too long to realize was the public library. The library, with no one there to interrupt him. The library, and all the time in the world. Henry had finally found something to perk him up a bit. To his delight, he discovered that most of the books were still intact. He immediately began to sort out everything he had ever wanted to read, and everything he had never heard of. The complete works of William Shakespeare, the Divine Comedy, the Odyssey. Every book he could ever want to absorb was here. And there was time! He pushed his glasses up and got to work. By the end of the day, Mr. Bemis had sorted hundreds of books, and had even had time to loot a bounty of canned goods from the local grocery store. On top of the sturdy public library sign that had fallen off the building, he had piled enough soft materials to make a passable cot. Henry sat and pulled his first tome toward himself and inhaled deeply as he opened the first book, taking in the smell of the old pages. Henry wasn't sure if it was an aftershock of the bombing or the rubble he was perched on simply settling and shifting, but the jolt knocked Henry over. He dropped his book, but what was more, with an unmistakable crack, his thick, heavy glasses hit the stone and shattered. Henry looked, unseeing, into the vacant world around him, no longer able to discern words from empty pages, nor stacks of books from stacks of rubble. In all the death and destruction that had occurred in the city that day, it was the breaking of his glasses that was the most interest to Henry Bemis. Their destruction was all he cared about when his dream lay before him, and he had time enough at last. There are several themes we can pull from this story. Obviously, the be careful what you wish for or you might not get it. Or you just might get it. I messed that one up. Gave you the opposite message. Be careful what you wish for or you just might get it is the first one thinks about. Henry spends most of the story upset that all of his time either belongs to his wife or his boss. He doesn't have a moment to himself to read a book. Though honestly, Henry wants more than just a moment. He wants to read a full novel cover to cover without stopping. I don't even see how that's possible if it's a novel of any size. You've got to stop to at least like get a drink of water or something at some point, right? I mean, I've done pretty close to this. I think the last Harry Potter book I read in like 2 days. But, you know, it's not something that most people have the time to do, especially most adults. And so he's reading voraciously with the same kind of appetite that I did as a child or a teenager on summer break, because he didn't have that opportunity when he was younger with his vision and everything. So he's kind of a childish character in that sense, that he's got this hole in his life that he feels like he can never make up for. The story kind of also addresses solitude versus loneliness. Henry isn't really bothered that much by the fact that there aren't very many people around, indicating that he's a pretty introverted person. When he's all alone is kind of when he's at his happiness happiest. And so it explores the idea that just because you're alone, just because you're solitary, doesn't mean you're necessarily lonely. Some people being alone drives them absolutely crazy. My husband is like this. He likes to be around other people. Now, he doesn't like large groups, but he always wants to be in at least like a small gaggle of 2 to 8 people. And so when he comes home from work, it's strange to me because he never really seems to want any alone time. If anything, he wants me with him all the time. Whereas I'm the kind of person that not only enjoys my time alone, but I really thrive in it. I find it's when I'm most productive. And it's been that way for a long time. Even as a teenager, I would listen to my radio for just hours and hours and hours, just enjoying some time to myself. And it's kind of how I decompress, which is, from what I've read, pretty normal for introverts. Being introverted doesn't necessarily mean you're shy. It just means that your kind of internal energy battery is refueled with your alone time, and then being with people, even if you like being with people, kind of drains your battery. Whereas for extroverts, it's the opposite. Being with people recharges you, and being alone drains your battery. So for me, like, I like people enough, you know, and I don't dislike being around people, which is kind of the stereotype of introverts. I like people very much. I'm kind of a people pleaser. But my alone time is when I recharge from all of the time that I've spent trying to make everyone around me happy, right? And so I get the feeling that Henry Bemis is definitely an introvert, though I don't think perhaps like me, where he does kind of like being around people. Henry's sole goal in life seems to be to kind of have time for himself and to just read a book, which seems like a simple request, but his desire for it kind of comes at the detriment of everyone else. But the feeling here we're exploring is just that just because he's alone doesn't necessarily mean he's lonely. And any other introverts, whether it's because you're shy or because you don't like people or simply because you're like me and your alone time is really when you kind of recharge, any of us can kind of understand that just because you're alone doesn't necessarily mean you're lonely. And I think we see that with Henry here, though he does seem to just kind of dislike people, which I can't particularly relate to. Bemis's loss of his glasses is sometimes seen as punishment for his lack of grief at the death of others. This especially hit me, not necessarily with his boss, because to me, a person's boss isn't really their friend. It's just kind of a part of the machine that is their working environment. You know, your boss is more of a tool to me, at least, than a companion. And so I get not being super emotionally worn out because his boss had passed away, but you know, you'd think he'd be a little more torn up over the fact that his wife is gone. That's a little more upsetting, Henry. You know, sounding a little sociopathy there. You know, your spouse, you should definitely be a little more upset about. Now, in the short story, it does kind of reflect that he says Agnes hadn't really been a bad wife per se, but his thoughts never really linger on her, even after the realization hits that she's passed away. And that strikes me as very, very strange. So perhaps, you know, taking what I was saying earlier about him being an introvert, perhaps it's something a little more than that. Perhaps he's got some kind of emotional stunting there where he doesn't really seem to have any kind of attachment to anybody whatsoever. It's also kind of seen as a cautionary tale about an over-reliance on technology and even societal structures that are easily dismantled. This is kind of pertinent today when we think about the fact that most reading that we do doesn't come from actual books. It comes from our cell phones, our Kindles, our iPads, our laptops. You know, very few people actually pick up an honest page-turning book to such an extent that there are jokes and memes online, you know, of children when they have a book and they try to just scroll their finger across the page to turn the page because they've never had to actually turn a page before, and the adult in the room is usually laughing at them. But the sad fact of the matter is you are only ever one, you know, overtired power plant employee or EMP or broken charger cable away from not having that anymore. And so there's kind of a charm to those old school books that are seen as kind of an older thing now, you know, something people don't use anymore, because even if the power goes out, you can light a candle or go outside in the sunshine and still read your book. You're not dependent upon, you know, other people in order to enjoy your books. And so I think with Henry's case, this is represented kind of with his glasses, and that he's completely reliant upon them to even be able to enjoy his favorite pastime. But yeah, there's kind of that over-reliance on technology and everything around you to just kind of take care of you that has become a strong part of this message here as we as a society grow more and more technologically dependent. There's another message, but this is kind of the most popular message I saw relating to this story, and that's kind of the thought to not wait to live your life. We often plan ahead for some idealized version of the future where we can finally do everything that we dream of, whether it's retirement or whether it's a child looking forward to when they grow up and they can have the power to make their own decisions instead of having everything chosen for them. We always kind of idealize this point in the future where things will be the way, you know, finally be the way that we want them to be. And how many times have we heard of a couple who saves plans for travel and adventure after retirement, only for one or both of them to become ill or even pass away before that dream is realized? And it's kind of basically the first, 10-15 minutes of the movie Up. There's a reason why that's so heartbreaking to us. It's because we can both relate to it and we both kind of fear it, because it's something that we can definitely see happening to us in our lives, because we all seem to know at least one couple that this has happened to. This cannot be at the expense of our responsibilities, of course. You shouldn't be, you know, putting off the things that you need to do, like responsible spending and saving and stuff, in order to just go out and play all the time. That's not exactly what the story's trying to tell you, but it's definitely got some commentary there on waiting to live your life until after your life is over. But on the other hand, it doesn't completely exonerate Henry in this either, because he is a kind of a childish, selfish oaf the whole time too. It's like with his inability to read and develop academically, like that somehow also held him back emotionally. He doesn't seem to have really matured beyond thinking about what he wants at any time. Now, this story first came out as a short story by Lynn Venable in If magazine. In the short story, the wife was Agnes, which is why that's the name I used here in my story. However, in the Twilight Zone episode, season 1, episode 8, Time Enough at Last, Agnes's name was actually Helen in the show, which is kind of interesting. I don't see really any story reason why they would have changed her name. I don't know.
maybe just to have Henry and Helen both start with the first initial. She's not really a very big character, so the name change seems strange to me, just because it seems kind of unnecessary. It's one of the most famous episodes of The Twilight Zone, so clearly I'm not the only person that this story kind of resonated with and lingered with in my thoughts. I also kind of love the one with the girl with the doppelganger and stuff like that. The story, or the series, is kind of infamous for these episodes that make you think. They have multiple layers of messaging there, some of which sometimes the messaging would contradict itself. One message that you could pull from it was this, and one message you could pull from it was that. And this is one of the ones that kind of lingered with me the longest. And I definitely enjoyed it. I didn't know there was a short story, so my first introduction to this story was through The Twilight Zone, and it's kind of funny. So then whenever I'm reading it, I always kind of hear Rod Serling's voice in my head, Mr. Henry Bemis, and I need to be careful not to slide into a bad Rod Serling imitation, because let's be honest, it would be bad. I'm not a good impressionist as it is, and then his voice is very, very different from my own as well. But this is definitely an episode of The Twilight Zone and a short story that have stuck with me for ages, ever since the first time I saw it, and it's been parodied so many times that it definitely sticks with others as well, I think. And I hope that you enjoyed the story as much as I did. Just seeing that it's also a short story in written form kind of added, at least, to my delight in the telling of it. I guess I need to pay more attention, though, to the credits at the end of The Twilight Zone, or I would have already realized that. What did you get out of Henry Bemis's story? I do like that he is kind of bullied and put upon, but at the same time, he's also not without blame in that situation himself. It's like, on one hand, people in his life don't treat him very nicely, and they kind of boss around and dominate him. But on the other hand, he's such a weenie, you know? So it's interesting. You know, there's not a character in here that's particularly right or wrong. They're just several people with good points that kind of don't treat each other very kindly, and in the end they're robbed of the chance to do so. So I don't know. Again, I think he's must be emotionally stunted in some way, because most people would linger more over the fact that their wife had disappeared, but they don't seem to get along that well in the first place. But even when you don't get along with your spouse, you probably give them more than just a passing thought, I would think. I don't know. I get along with mine, so I can't really relate to that. But it's just weird to me that he doesn't even think of her that long. I don't know. Let me know your thoughts in the comments, and thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed this. And again, if you do want to see it wonderfully played out by Burgess Meredith, check out The Twilight Zone Season 1, Episode 8. He's so fantastic. I do love this moment where he realizes what he's survived. In the Twilight Zone episode, it specifically states that it's an H-bomb, whereas in the short story, it just says it's some newly developed weapon, which may be the H-bomb. But when he first realizes he's survived, he's telling himself, oh, this is okay. Look at this. I've survived this incredible thing. I'm really very fortunate. But then the panic is hitting him at the same time. So he jumps immediately from, I'm really very fortunate, to this pitiful little help, 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 because he's got both of those thoughts going on at the same time. You know, what are the odds that I survived this? But also, how am I going to survive life after this? And Burgess Meredith plays it so fantastically. And I hope you enjoy it. I definitely recommend to go out and watch it. It is kind of a cultural touchstone, I think, because it's been parodied so much. I mean, even The Walking Dead has parodied this scene, so, which is probably a really, really fitting tribute, honestly. But check it out. It's an awesome episode of an incredible show. The Twilight Zone is a show that I really never get sick of. I only enjoy it more as I get older. I love the old-time format. I love the narrator, and I love that kind of mixture between whimsy and ominousness that kind of accompanies every episode. So let me know again how you feel about the show, and please like, share, and subscribe so that the show can grow. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a beautiful weekend.